Cinematologist podcast. I'm Dario Linares, and down the line, of course, is Neil Fox. Neil, afternoon, sir.
Hello, good afternoon.
How are you doing?
Doing really well. It's the first week of teaching, and it's going okay, as well as it can, you know, when there's 100 new students and no one's really done anything for a few months. It's, it's been fun. I mean, I'm enjoying being back, and it's a good bunch of students that we've got in the first year, and nice to see some of the second and third years again as well. So yeah, it's so far so good. Yourself?
Yeah, pretty good. We're just in freshers week this week, so we start teaching next week. Really interesting on Monday when the students turned up, because we've quadrupled our cohort. So, you know, from going from a year where we had quite low numbers to going to rooms full is quite an interesting transition. You're like, oh, bloody hell, yeah, this is real again. I think the cohort looked lively, interested, you know, want to talk about films, which is all you can ask for really in the very first week of term. So we'll see how it goes from next week. So have you managed to see anything, you know, with all this going on?
Yeah, always got to make time to watch some films. I think that's the key to our profession, is make sure that you try and find the time to watch stuff. And I've been doing that consistently, really, in the last few weeks, and particularly the last week or so has been really good. I finally caught Tony Erdmann. Which I just thought was wonderful and as good as everyone says. I mean, just, yeah, so clever, so sweet, so moving, really funny and uncomfortable, but, you know, brilliantly performed. So that was a real treat. And then I also saw The Edge of 17, which is this teen movie, which a lot of people were talking about, and I can see why. It's really, yeah, it's a really good movie, really smart again, great performances, really well written, and maybe kind of going to my teaching on Monday, remembering that, you know, originality is not everything it's cracked up to be. Sometimes you can take something familiar that people know in terms of where it's placed in a genre and what it's trying to do, but also be fresh and invigorating and kind of have a really interesting take on it. And sometimes just good writing and good performance and good direction is just all you need. So they were two particular ones. And I've been catching the Raul Ruiz films on Mubi as well, which has been an absolute joy. So yeah, pretty good couple of weeks.
Superb. Yeah, I've managed to get into the cinema to watch a few things. I was really sort of worried that I hadn't actually been, you know, utilising the film-going experience as much as I should have done. And I went to see Mother. You know, obviously everybody's sort of talking about it. It was something I'd kind of wanted to have my own opinion on. And yeah, what was interesting about it was not necessarily the madness of the film itself, because I think, you know, as a film, it is a little bit like a Rorschach test. You know what I mean? You just read yourself or what you like or hate about films onto it. But what was really interesting to me, and I wish I had the time to write something about this, was seeing other films around it in relationship to it, because earlier on, a couple of weeks before, I'd seen Nocturama, which suddenly looked like a much better film and a much more precise, and a film that knew what it was doing a lot more after seeing Mother. I mean, Mother I did find really interesting, and it is sort of bravura filmmaking in many ways, but it's almost like he is throwing, as he does, sort of throws the kitchen sink at the screen and sort of says, well, take it or leave it, in a way. So I saw Nocturama, and I just think, oh, that it's made me think about that film a lot more. And then I think a week later, I saw A Ghost Story, which I absolutely loved. It's my film of the year so far. And all of these three films are interesting, I think, because they are very polemic. So people have kind of come out on both sides seeing these, you know, these films are a disaster, or they are, you know, absolutely wonderful experiences. And A Ghost Story was just everything I love about films that offer themselves up to a kind of ambiguous interpretation, but still seem to have a precise command over what they are doing. This sort of beautiful symbolic image of Casey Affleck with the sheet over his head throughout the whole film, and it's so aware of how ridiculous that kind of looks, but it the way it's kind of used as an anchoring point for everything that else that's going on around is really beautifully done. The way it uses time and space, the way it is cine-literate as well, sort of referencing, I mean, I just thought there was a lot of Godard in there, a lot of Bergman in there as well. Again, it left you as an audience member to really try and think about what it is trying to say, if it's trying to say anything desperate. But allows you to make inferences and allusions to what cinema should be doing, and also kind of what life is and what we're all doing here, that kind of profundity. And I think that, you know, I can understand why, you know, people, and I think it's great that people would have gone into this thinking it's just a generic horror genre film and walked out because of that. And that's exactly what I want people to do in a movie. I want 3/4 of the audience to kind of walk out, and me to be the one left there thinking this is a work of genius. And it kind of had that effect. And I also saw Borg versus McEnroe, which I really enjoyed. I mean, it's had some really, really kind of snotty reviews, I think, in certain places, but it really reminded me of Creed a lot, actually. Mm. And I thought what was interesting about it was the parallel between the competition between Borg and McEnroe as characters in history, obviously, you know, if you follow tennis, or even if you don't, you kind of know that they were big rivals. But then the difference between Sevier Gudnason, I think that's how you pronounce it, his method of acting, and then Shia LaBeouf on the other side. It was really interesting because Gudnason, he really does sort of do this character acting bit, inhabits the character, and it's a very different movie when he's on screen and it's portraying the Borg character to when it moves over to Shia LaBeouf, who is essentially doing a kind of cosplay of McEnroe. You know, it's just Shia LaBeouf wearing all of the clothes and the hair, but being himself. But that is still really entertaining. So I kind of I've enjoyed the profound films I've seen, but I also enjoyed going to see this really entertaining biopic that does take a lot of poetic license, I think, but really good fun in the end.
Great stuff. The breadth of cinema all encompassed in those films there, I think. So
yeah, you can't beat it. So Neil, we've discussed what we've seen. So what have we got coming up on today's show?
So today's episode is in association with the ICA and the School of Film and Television here at Falmouth. And it is about a season called Crossings, which is a series of films and talks and things about migration, a particular kind of recent filmic representations and recent kind of news stories and events in that arena. And the season has been sort of funded and programmed in part by a colleague here at the School of Film and Television, Laura Canning, who works with Nico Mazzano, who's one of their programmers at the ICA. And they've been sort of, the ICA has been sort of screening films for since June around the country and doing events. And we've had a lot of screenings down here, both at the university, but kind of taking films out into the cinemas. So we've been in Newlyn at the Filmhouse, where we like to go and do some podcasting. And at the Poly, which is an arts venue here in Falmouth, and also the WTW Plaza Cinema in Truro, where they hosted a wonderful 35mm screening of Shaya Makhmalbaf's Blackboards. It's been a really kind of varied and interesting, difficult season in many ways, but a kind of timely season. And they invited us to kind of talk about these ideas and screen some of the work and present some of the work for the podcast. So I went down to Newlyn at the beginning of September and introduced Gianfranco Rossi's Fire at Sea with our friends on the podcast, Kingsley Marshall and Mark Jenkin. And then just last week at the Poly in Falmouth, we screened The Nine Muses, and Laura joined me on stage to talk about John Akinfra's really wonderful and impenetrable and kind of fascinating essay documentary about kind of almost the history of kind of 20th century British migration that then also feeds into this kind of ideological idea of the migrant stretching back to both kind of Greek oral histories and beyond to kind of the beginning of time. It's really something. And a week later, I still don't have my head around it. So that was a great experience. And it was nice because the audiences have been a mix of kind of regular, for want of a better term, cinema goers. And then The Nine Muses was a chance for us to screen something challenging for our freshers. It's a slightly different episode in the sense that there's two live events that we've covered. So we've got the intro and the kind of Q&A discussion from both of those. I think that when I sort of said yes, we'd do it, I wasn't sure how the episode would go, but hearing people's responses to these films and having not seen either of them and kind of being in that moment after the film with the audiences, I really wanted to share that aspect of it on the podcast. So that's why we're going to kind of do both of the Q&As, because I think that the conversation about the films and the topics is kind of the key and kind of the reason that the season exists in the first place.
Wonderful. Yeah, so I think, well, let's just get into that now. So this is Neil and the team at Newlyn discussing Fire at Sea.
Good evening. Welcome to the Cinematologist podcast and welcome to Newlyn Filmhouse. An absolute joy to screen here again. Only the second time we've been here for the podcast. We were here last Christmas for Gremlins, which was great fun. And a very, very different type of film this evening is in store. I'm joined by my friends and colleagues, Kingsley. Hello, Kingsley.
Hello, Neil.
And Mark Jenkin. Hello.
Hello.
So thank you for joining us for this film. And tonight we're watching Gianfranco Rossi's documentary, Oscar-nominated documentary, Fire at Sea. And it's part of a season called Crossings, which is a collaboration between the ICA, the Goethe Institute, and the School of Film and Television. So, Kingsley, can you sort of let us know what the season is about?
Yeah, so the gist of how this started was a couple of years ago. We take students to Berlin every year to the film festival in February, and a couple of years ago, the talk of the festival was stories about migration and stories about displaced peoples, I guess. And many of the films that came out of that did very well in the awards season, but it generated a conversation. But so that was kind of in the back of our mind. And then a colleague, a programmer, had come down from the ICA in London and had talked about this season. We thought it was everything that we try and instill in the filmmakers at the university. So I'm the head of film at Falmouth University in the School of Film and TV, and I work with Neil and Mark there with a number of students. So these movies are all about kind of representation of people and social politics and in part economics and part conflict and all those kind of things, these kind of modern things of our times.
Yeah, and I think what was exciting was when this film came up as the one that the film house wanted to show and that was on Laura's listed. It kind of ties in nicely with something that we were talking about on the podcast a few episodes ago, which was about probably my favourite film this year I've seen, which is Karis Mackie's The Other Side of Hope. You know, and we talked a lot about immigration stories in that around that film, and it feels like culturally there's a critical mass in terms of stories of migration and displacement, and it feels like that cinema is actively addressing those things, both documentary and narrative, in ways that they probably are not addressing as in terms of what's going on in contemporary culture with other issues, which I think it's why it's such an interesting kind of stream of cinema at the moment, because there's so many great films that are, and not great, great films that are, which I hope was the case with tonight's, but certainly seems to be what people have said about it, is that it's using the form of cinema to tell these stories. And in terms of the critical mass, there's a great piece in the current Film Comment, which has just come out, it dropped last week, and it's Girish Shambu talking about 100 years of immigration cinema, and particularly talk about Jonas Mekas's Lost. There's a couple of things I just wanted to kind of say, sort of quote from it, because I think it really sets the context for this season and for these kind of stories. And he's talking about Lost, and he says, especially in its first hour, it's among cinema's most poignant accounts of the immigrant experience. During the first two reels, Mekas chronicles 4 years spent amid the Lithuanian exile community in Williamsburg, a period that began with a strong belief in the myth of return to the homeland and ended with the crushing realisation that this would never come to pass. And what's so striking about films about kind of immigration, migration, is the good ones really capture that duality of place and self, that where you're coming from, where you're going to, and the result of that is kind of not belonging to anywhere, which is a common theme. He says, the desperate search for settledness manifests for Mekas as a heightened sensory awareness of the everyday, an impulse to seize and treasure the quickly passing moment. And I hope that that's something that we will experience in today's film. What excites me about this film, and it was a film that I wanted to show for the podcast quite a while back, was because it seemed like a film which was kind of formally engaging with the content, kind of not just a simple talking heads, not a simple kind of like document of this kind of story, but using the powerful tools of cinema to tell this kind of story. And I know that's something you're interested in, is the kind of the formal aspects, Mark, of documentary.
Yeah, I've just done a little bit of reading about the film, and it almost seems a bit flippant to kind of talk about the form when you're dealing with such a serious issue, because it's issue led. But and then I started thinking, but that's what normally turns me off documentaries is sort of message kind of message filmmaking, which is in narrative film as much as documentary, but it's more obvious in documentary, and that's what I have a bit of a problem with the documentary form in that sense. But having read about it, and you know, the accolades, it got the Golden Bear in Berlin, right, and then the Oscar nomination, yeah, and then reading a bit more about it, I think it's, you know, intriguing proposition really, and again it does. I do feel a little bit conscious of talking about the form without having seen the film, yeah, and without, you know, whilst kind of dismissing the subject matter to a certain extent. But we do see it is a story. It's a subject matter that we see over and over again, packaged in a very specific way, designed to kind of shock us in a very populist context as well. Because now, recently over the last year and a half or whatever, immigration and migration, I think, has kind of been recontextualizing domestic sense with Brexit and all of this kind of stuff. And it just seems to be getting smaller and smaller and simpler and simpler. So it's really exciting to see a film that's, at least from what I've read, is using the cinematic form.
That's part of the reason for doing a season as well, rather than just a one-off screening, that we hear migration stories in news media, and they're broadly framed in the same way, no matter who's migrating from where to where, and for whatever reason, they're presenting in a certain way. And I think by showing six movies of migration stories around the world in different eras for very different reasons, you get a better sense of it. And I think also living with characters for 90 minutes, 100 minutes, whatever, gives you more than that 30-minute news burst. And to me, that's what cinema does. It can backfill these issues. And I think with the Berlinale story, with this movie, that had been a slow burn for years and years and years. And many of the films that we're screening, some are older, much older, some are contemporary, but they're all trying to deal with whatever that story is, but in the moment in which they're made. So they're reflective of that time. And I think that's what we're going to see in this.
Well, let's find out. Let's hope that all of our hopes and dreams can be fulfilled in this one film. So, thank you for joining us. Let's crack on with Rossi's Fire at Sea.
It's an incredible film, isn't it? And it's very difficult to talk about afterwards. And I think the way the structure of it, to go from this, what I would consider real life, you know, the family life and the boy and the history and this pattern of a relationship with the sea and the island and the homeliness and everyday life, and, you know, and things that we worry about, losing our eyesight or asthma, you know, whatever, anxiety. And then to this extremity of these peoples, where it just asks questions of you to ask questions of the film. And I thought that was really fascinating. I think that's why I'm reeling from it a little bit, that the people on the boats, the kind of migrants, how they identified with where they'd been and kind of where, how they travel through places rather than really where they were from. And the Italian authorities, who were really astonishing. And I that was kind of breathtaking, the doctor, the people on the ships, and how their humanity, you know, duty as well, but it was certainly humanity about not questioning that and doing the best they could for these people. And the film didn't kind of deal really with the context of it. It just put it back into the audience's face all the time. And I found those breaks between the kind of structure really hard work. And the final tableau was just, we were all silent, and you know, which seems appropriate. But I didn't think the film was going to take us into that place. It'd taken us everywhere else, and it'd taken us on the journey of the survivors, and a lot of talk about it kind of survival rather than death. But it started with death and ended with death. And I thought that was fascinating. And the allegorical stuff with him, you know, finding his sight, I thought was really beautifully done. And, you know, you see that often in movie narratives, and often it's quite on the nose, but I thought it fitted really well. I'm deeply moved by it. And what I said at the start about how the news doesn't backfill this thing, I've heard of this island. I've never been there. I feel like I've spent time there now. I feel like, you know, it feels like I went to Malta earlier in the year, and it feels a bit like that, or Crete, just an island, you know, with regular people doing regular stuff. But
being the focus of this place from these North Africa, you know, people moving from North Africa, particularly Libya, was really, really striking. Mm. So really moved. I haven't got much to say about the form. I thought they just it was overpowering.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mark.
I could talk about the form a little bit. I thought it'd be interesting to know how many shots were in that.
Yeah.
And compare that to a sort of news package that you'd normally see of the same thing. And I think, you know, you're saying that there was no context. I think all the context was in there, really. And I think the news is the thing that removes the context of it. And I heard somebody say the other day, I was at a performance of something, and somebody said, oh, you know, talking about the migrant crisis, and they were saying, the refugee crisis, saying, you know, it's not as big as it was a little while ago, but it is still there. And you think, well, it hasn't gone away. It's just our focus of attention has gone away from it because people get bored of watching the same thing over and over again. So to see something like that where the context was all there and linked to the everyday, like you say, you know, and just the little touches like the, you know, the little boy kind of old beyond his years diagnosing himself with anxiety and the doctor trying to, you know, say that the anxiety is caused, your symptoms are caused by anxiety, which is then giving you anxiety. And it's just like, you know, that's not to compare that to what the refugees are going through, but just to sort of think of that as all of the same. That's all part of the same thing.
There was a bit with the sequence with the eclipse and the constant pictures of the sea, and it's a great film to show Newlyn, right? Where we've seen kind of many of those images. It felt biblical at stages because there's a timelessness to this. You know, the moon, the tides, the sea, movement across the sea, the different kind of boats, and all that stuff. It felt traditional, and it didn't feel of a movie 2 years ago. It could be 1,000 years ago. And I think, you know, you say about migrancy, people move for all kinds of reasons around the world.
And that's what Rossi said about the, because he went and spent 6 months there without a camera and just embedded himself in the community. And he said, he said to the doctor, why do you accept these people? And he said, because we're fisher folk.
Of course, yeah.
And that's what you do. If somebody's in trouble on the sea, you rescue them. And also, you're constantly having people coming and going. So to have this big transient community come through, aside from the sort of catastrophe of it all, it's not necessarily a big deal. And that was kind of interesting. And you know, it's all summed up in that one line. The doctor says, isn't it, that as a human, it's your duty to help these people. Mm. You know, and compulsion or whatever it is.
The boats are significant, aren't they? A lot of those boats are, like the big wooden boat towards the end, it just made me think of Cuba or Vietnam or previous crises of migration.
The blue boat.
Yeah. It felt of many places, you know, it was not geographically significant kind of thing, you know. And a lot of those pictures of the people in place, there were different kinds of people, which I've kind of never really thought about too much before. You kind of think you book your passage on one of these boats and you go from Libya or, you know, they asked that question. They kept assuming there were groups of people from certain places, weren't they?
Yeah.
That sequence in the middle of the football game is really a lovely way of kind of explaining they're fleeing different things. And they've ended up in the same place to get across the meadow.
And then using football to celebrate.
Yeah, the universal
the thing that
language.
Having to escape from, which is, you know, like, I can't remember who said it, you know, celebrating the place that made us refugees. I think it might be Shane McGowan, actually. But it's that idea, yeah, that you suddenly, it all becomes tribal again. But it's about giving meaning, isn't it, I suppose. Yeah.
And that's part of their identity, that they have had to leave, but it doesn't leave them. You know, and I think that is something that's part of the Lampedusa community as well. I mean, a couple of things I thought was, one was, yeah, like it reminded us what the news is, you know, and how the news operates. And this idea of Lampedusa as this symbolic place, and that was about what that place is really like, which none of the news outlets are even interested in.
But not just news, you know, as well, most representations.
Yeah.
You know, the news is the obvious one and kind of easy target, but most portrayals, you know, so it's a real incredible way of being that sort of stark with it.
There's a moment in it that really struck me that was, we talk about cinema a lot, cinematologists, but that struck me as deeply cinematic. You wouldn't really see it in the news documentary. It's when the refugees are coming on the boat and they're all having the picture taken with the number. I don't know who they are and where they're from. And people smiling to the camera because you smile for the camera when you have your photo taken. You've gone through this deeply distressing trip. And I couldn't imagine that on a TV doc, certainly not the news, because you dehumanise people. Doesn't That's fit. The point of it. Yeah, it doesn't fit this kind of crowd. There's 40 people dead in the boat and you've just had a picture taken and you smile because it's the thing that you do. And I thought that was... It said a lot about the movie for me, and it really where it really all clicked into place about what the filmmakers were trying to do, which was to humanise people without hearing their voices, or like you said about documentary form, typically the to camera, you know, in a blackened studio, and you tell your story, or it's narrated. This isn't narrated in that traditional way, or the boy is used as this kind of signifier of something else. By avoiding all that. And I think it would be chaff. It's rubbish. You don't need it here because the images speak for themselves and the people are speaking for themselves without actually...
But they're speaking for people, aren't they? I think that's what I found really profound about it, was that so much of the discourse now in society is, you know, well, particularly from those who are, you know, responsible, inverted commas, you know, is that there's no comment on individual cases. It's data. Everything's data, you know. And this was a film which was saying, no, actually... Everyone's an individual. There is only individual cases. Mm-hmm. You know, you might have a mass of numbers, mm-hmm. but each one's an individual case. And what I found so beautiful was that the people on the island, we got to know them. And then when we saw, which I thought was formerly beautiful, was when we saw these migrants and refugees who we can never know, and the film can never know them, we saw them as people, and we saw their lives through the lives of the people that we'd seen in the village. And I just thought that was... so powerful, because that's why I always shout at the radio when you know when the latest Tory is saying we don't comment on an individual case, and it's like we are all individual case. Everybody who's affected, yeah, is, you know what I mean? It's
like looking at individual cases, because then suddenly it becomes universal.
Well, exactly, yeah, exactly.
There's enough space in there to think, well, what the this isn't the fault of a specific group of people. You know, it's not the fault of the people trafficked. Ultimately, it's not the fault of the people traffickers. It's not the fault of, you know, whoever is. It's the fault of the system. This is a byproduct of a sort of capitalist society, isn't it? And the kind of waste that it creates.
It did fascinating things with numbers, didn't it? So it, at the start, that title card said 15,000 people dead. Now I can't even imagine what 15,000 people looks like. I'd find it very difficult to kind of understand. And at the end, it said 40 people had died on that boat. And then you get a sense of the scale of it, don't you? And it did this zooming in and out of those ideas where they're chatting. Yeah, we hear 15,000, you count 15,000, 100,000, you know, what does that mean in a year? And then the beautiful moments in the sea as well as on the sea and seeing, oh, I know what that means now. It means people drowned at the bottom of the ocean under that, they're never going to be recovered or whatever.
But also that sequence with the blue boat as well, because of the weather and the sort of colour palette and everything, and you think, oh shit, that's a lot of people on that boat, but the sea's calm and the rescue services are there, and then you see them handing out life jackets. You think, oh, it's all right,
got them all.
Just going to give them life jackets and then maybe just escort them along, and then people in real bad state start coming over the rail, and then you see them on the deck of the rescue boat and you think, oh, are they alive, are they dead? And then he says, yeah, this person's so dehydrated, put them on a drip, they might not make it. But you're still thinking, yeah, but they might make it. So, and you kind of, and that guy's breathing, but it's really bad breathing, but at least he's alive, and it's all about these five people. And then it just gets worse and worse and worse.
The capture of it is when people break,
isn't it? It's like a microcosm,
isn't it? In that moment where the guy turns away and is caught on the mic, you know, issues of profanity, and he says it, and I felt it. You know, you knew what he was saying. The same with the doctor saying, you know, people assume you get used to it. You don't get used to it. And it's not just the way he says it. It's the framing of, to get to that point of the interview or to get to that point at the moment, that tableau where there's two bodies here and it's on the helicopter deck and there's four people just stood there like a painting. And it doesn't matter how we've reached that moment. But as a member of the audience, you're kind of thinking, "What? Who does this job? And how do you face this?" day after day after day, where you can't deal with those bigger issues of the creation of the crisis through whatever means that is. And it the film forces you into that position, doesn't it? What am I doing about it? What are other people doing about it? What's my place in this? You know.
And how does it manifest? How does not dealing with it manifest itself in individuals? You know, and then you've got the boy who can't get his breath.
Yeah.
doesn't know why. Yeah. That was like a microcosm of the whole.
Yeah.
Sort of like, yeah.
Powers. That's enough from us, I think, for now. Anybody want to add anything out in the audience?
I feel like we've watched a completely different film. I don't get your take on it at all. So I found it really full of images of empty streetscapes. There was no one in that town. And the family you saw were completely isolated. You saw them in their home. You didn't see them interacting with anyone else. You didn't see any acknowledgement them, that they were aware of what was going on around them. They were living their lives, and there was no sense of where these migrants went when they got there, or the effect of that, or how the island people felt about it. So I didn't get a sense of, you know, acceptance and, you know, people doing good things for these people. It, especially the language they used when they were kind of patting them down, and they were saying, another one, another one, another one. And none of them in the whole film ever spoke to one of the migrants, said anything to them, and none of the migrants did anything. That smile on the camera was the only thing. So I found it very quite isolating, quite a cold piece of filmmaking with these odd, funny bits of kids, which I found really difficult in terms of there being no kind of narrative, and I don't really get your take on it. I can see why you want to feel that, but I didn't feel the film showed that, not for me.
Yeah, I think I think through some of its form, so that there's some, when the people originally end up in the camp from the bus. So in the bus, they just sat, they're completely static. They moved around from place to place, aren't they? They're frisked, they're redressed, they all wear the same shoes. They move to that camp and the camera immediately closes everything down. The people don't really move. And I think, for me, the film was saying, this is a stage, something will happen after that stage. And it doesn't have to answer that question. I don't need to see what happens next. I didn't feel that way. While the kids traverse the island, they do things, they do the things both that they should do and that they shouldn't do. You know, the glasses, metaphorically, he's resistant to it initially, then he feels it working, then he does something about it. They can't see, and I think that the blindness metaphor is in that, or that moment where you're going to get trapped between the customs boats, or whatever they call them, the patrol boats. It is there. It's there, right in front of them, and they see them landing these people. And there was a funny moment where a bus drives by in the dark, with the people who'd come off one of the ships, and there was a gunshot or a thunderclap or something. And I thought, is that resistance to it, or, you know, is someone throwing a stone at the bus? Is what I thought immediately. And I think the film's doing that all the time. All the time, there is this undercurrent of, this is happening. We all know about it. We all know about it in the room. That's partly why we're here, or, you know, why we're talking about it. But how do you deal with a problem of this magnitude? And the child, the kid, is a metaphor for that. He can't do anything about it. And the older parents have seen conflict and war, and they've been isolated on this island before, and they've seen, you know, ships at sea and all those kind of things. They've experienced that, and this is just another manifestation of that. I wrote down one point: is this a war? If it's a war, who is it between? Because all you see are victims. I think the service personnel are doing their thing, but I think you're right about the people in the town. They're just going about their business, but that's what they do. You know, there's a bit where the family are fed, and again, it felt like something profound was trying to be said, because it was about liquid again. and it was about red, and it was about stuff out of the sea that was alive and is now dead, or has been cleaned up and whatever. And there were so many interconnections in the film. The doctor cutting off the ears, presumably for DNA or something, I've no idea. It didn't explain itself, but I thought that there was this undercurrent of meaning, but it put it back on us all the time. And that's, you know, I don't think you're wrong. I don't think I'm right, but I think for me, it was making me think about what does this mean as a film? Because the two things were so oppositional about the experience at sea and experience on the island of people who live there. But that, I think that was the point.
Yeah, what I took from a lot of that, because I can see exactly what you mean, was that, you know, that Lampedusa is cited as the destination for these people in the, you know, but so it was saying to us, this is not the destination of these people, this is a transient place. All the people that are brusque are not people from that island. They're people from Italy or Sicily who come there to do that job because they are not island officials, they are national officials. And that's a juxtaposition with the people that we see who are, you know, that's their home. And I think these people, you know, the idea is, what I found interesting was spent so much time showing us what life is like for these people on this island in a community which has been ignored by its own country.
You know, and it's poor economically.
It's a very poor place with a very decrepit. No one lives there, and the narrative is that these people are fleeing for something better. We don't know where these people come from. We don't know what their existence is. This is their first stop, and then we get to see what the reality is of that migration, which is usually to places which are also poor, and ending up in these kind of places which have been forgotten, where people have to be bussed in order to manage this thing. I found it very difficult and complicated, but also very kind of human, because I think it was shining light on those things which I know I take for granted when I listen to broadcasts, when I listen to things. I do what most people do, which I think is just don't go the extra bit thinking, what is the reality for those people who live there, and is their life any better than what's, you know, how is their life different to what's being fled? And it's not really, in many ways, obviously apart from the war. You know, the reality there isn't, is very difficult, very poor. They all, you know, it's a very small community, and it's clear that migration in Lampedusa has happened. You know, that those people have gone somewhere else, probably economic migration due to fishing, due to the, you know, so all that stuff is, I felt it was in the film, not said, which is why I liked it, because it reminded me of those things which I think are kind of prevalent in, it was a very complicated idea, isn't it?
I'll just follow up with Mark about his comment about the form and the message of a documentary, because I think, not being too critical of it, I found that over cinematic for a documentary, and I think that's why I looked at it with a more critical eye rather than taking on board the metaphorical aspects of it that Kingsley was talking about. And I wonder whether you thought that message in that documentary was honest in the way that you mentioned before.
I think it is. I've got a problem with the terminology and of saying something's documentary, because it's such a broad kind of term. I think the way it's put together, kind of backing up what Neil was saying, the space within there to bring whatever you have already got to the story, if it is a story, or to the issue, I think works really well. And I don't think there is necessarily a specific message in there. And the thing, you know, and again, it does seem frivolous talking about form with a subject like this, but I think that's the alternative, is just to rely on straight sort of reporting of something, which is always dressed up as being objective, is always subjective, always fits a bigger narrative somewhere else. And I think this is a much more honest way of portraying a subject matter like this.
Because it shows its artifice or not?
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing, you know, 6 months of being on the island and getting to know these people so that they were happy to have a camera pointed at them. And there's little things that happens, like, you know, the little pans that go, sometimes the camera's static and then he moves the camera and it's almost to say, you know, there's somebody here, there is an authorship behind what you're watching. Obviously, you do get that with more straight documentary image and sound capturing, like News Gathering, but it's so bombastic and so overly authored with a voice over the top, the sort of eyewitness voice that's there. And not to deride journalism, but quite often it's of a certain language. You know, you could pick phrases out of one news report, put them over pictures from another news report, and it would just look exactly the same. So I think it's a more sophisticated way of portraying what's going on, but there's so much space in there. You know, certain metaphors you picked up on, I didn't get them, but now I can, you know, I can look at it again in my head and sort of and work out what was going on in that. And as a filmmaker, that's really interesting. Again, it makes me feel like I'm being a bit frivolous talking in that way, but I think there was. I think there was so much space in there, really. And that was, you know, I went in so many different directions watching it. And I think I probably did ask a lot of the questions of it that you asked of it. But I kind of, I think, you know, we have to make up our own answers to a lot of the questions. And that, it was, you know, when they were all being frisked and all that kind of stuff, and it was so sort of officious, and they were talking about them and stuff, and I was thinking, you know, I was just thinking, I'll just be a bit nicer to them. And you think, yeah, but is that really gonna help, or are those people able to do that after, you know, the fact that we see a shot that goes on for 4 minutes of this frisking, that's 4 minutes out of a shift that might have been 4 hours out of week after week after week. So that's sort of, you know, their ability to just not be, you know, their ability to still be doing the job is something that I just think is incredible, rather than maybe their lack of sort of personal, interpersonal skills or whatever it is.
I'll be quick because it's getting late, but from what struck me was a kind of a challenge of expectations. I came out we're going to watch fire at sea, we're going to see migrants, we're going to see land producer, all those images that had already been, you know, lodged in my brain from the way it's packaged previously that we've all touched on. And it turns out this is a song that's being played on the radio for A Fisherman's Wife. Yeah. And there was that kind of juxtaposition of my expectation, thinking that there's going to be a fire at sea sometime soon. And yeah, just as everybody's described, a challenging, very lyrical, beautiful, interesting film. So, thank you.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I think that's, I had exactly that same response when the song came on, you know. But and some of the, particularly in the early part of the film, I'm expecting more things because I'm conditioned in a narrative to expect things to happen. The title, The Boy with the Slingshot, all this is building up to something. But of course, it's not, isn't it? You know, it's something else, and it's not what I perceive it to be. There's a lot of that in the film about perception and who's, you know, without being too blunt, like how we see who watches, you know, all those kind of things are so subtly.
But that fire, the fire at sea song is sort of interesting as well, isn't it? Because that song's alluding to something that was horrific, but the passage of time has allowed that to, in this film, to be a bit of a respite from the current stuff. It's like, oh, a bit of nostalgia for the old
war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does this one?
Yeah, it's recording.
I guess I feel a bit angry because I feel it's quite difficult to intellectually human suffering. And I keep thinking about the Lord's Dubs Amendment in Hillsborough, and it's crashing, isn't it? But the little boy was great, and I kind of knew answered that question. But how could they have got that relationship? So it's like it was active, and he did brilliant sound effects. So I don't know, but it just seems remember drinking a glass of wine by Daniel Blake, and I've got that same sort of theme, which I guess is powerful filmmaking. But I'm not sure what happened to them, and whether they're gay, and I think the doctor was brutalised probably at the end of the day, and it's not nice for anyone in the community to have to deal with that one.
I find it amazing with a film like that that it is manipulative by its very nature, and it's doing many different things in making these interconnections between images. I'm interested in sound design. The sound design was non-naturalistic for most of the film, and some of that was really fascinating. The first migrants were seen through, it seemed like a sheet of plastic or something, it was probably off another boat, and the sound was totally flattened, so you couldn't hear them talk. And as soon as that happens, you're not seeing reality. Someone's done this in an edit suite or a dummy theatre or something. And there was a little moment of, we're going down that route. But immediately in the next scene, we did hear voices and conversations and things you could understand. And I think it's that ride through the film is the bit that makes it so complex. It's not an easy set of questions to tackle, is it? And it's a very difficult subject for a filmmaker to deal with. And everything about the movie is kind of saying, this is difficult to deal with, and I think that's okay, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it has the answers. It just wants you to think. It seems like this is someone who spent a lot of time in that place and wants more people to think about it.
But should we be acting rather than thinking?
Yeah.
Who knows? That's the big question, which I think we'll end on, suitably, lyrically and poetically. Thank you all for your contributions. Thank you for coming out for Fire at Sea. Thank you to Newlyn Film House for hosting us again. And yeah, we hope to see you all again in the future. Thanks to Mark and Kings for joining us as well.
Welcome.
And see you again. Thanks, everyone.
Buona domenica ed eccoci anche oggi ritrovati al quotidiano spazio dedicato all'informazione.
So that was our kind of evening at Newlyn talking about Fire at Sea. And one of the things kind of reading about that film in the season which kind of stuck with me, and I haven't formulated a really articulate kind of way of talking about it, but it feels like to me that the different aspects that cinema contains, you know, sound, image, movement, theatre, dance, you know, all these different things vying for attention seem to be kind of reflected in these stories, which are people kind of moving through different spaces, all of which are vying for attention and power. And also the individuals themselves who do this kind of end up with so many different types of characteristic and types of personality because of not only the changes they undergo, but the landscapes and the places that they move through. And I just wondered, you know, how you feel about kind of what's also known as kind of transnational cinema and these types of films, and whether the form and the kind of the stories are kind of closer entwined than they might be in other places.
Yeah, it's a difficult question. I mean, sort of transnational cinema is something I've kind of engaged with on an inconsistent basis, I would say. I mean, I think what's interesting, and it kind of came up a little bit in the discussion, there was quite a few things that came out that were interesting, was the way in which that relationship between form and content, and there seems to be a sort of uneasiness there, and like Mark Jenkin was picking up on that. And there's this clash, I think, between this idea of filmed material or the moving image. I don't want to sort of call it cinema at this point, but that idea that that there is somehow an understanding that needs to be reached about what is happening to these people in a definite way. And then sort of on the flip side of that idea that a camera is just observing and just showing you what is going on, and you bring yourself to that representation. So therefore the onus is on you to have your own context and understanding and sort of political ideas around this subject area. And I suppose it's that, again, it relates quite a lot to that problem of what is documentary and what should documentary be doing. And it really came out, I think, in terms of that first question or the statement that the lady made, where she'd felt that she'd seen a completely different film to you guys. And I did think, because I did watch the film, I had the same reaction to you that it wasn't attempting to make an expository case for a certain political or social outcome, or what should be happening, you know, politically to solve this problem in inverted commas of migration. And I think it's really interesting that she had that reaction, which was totally valid to have that reaction. But it's maybe that is that difference between, you know, what we get on a day-to-day basis in the news, you know, and then it goes off the news agenda. And it is that, it relates back to, I think, a little bit to that white Western viewpoint of, oh, here's the problem. What can we do to solve it? We argue over money. We argue over politics. We argue over boundaries. Nothing really gets solved. And then something else moves onto the agenda, like Brexit or Trump or whatever. Not to say that those things aren't interconnected. But I think it's really interesting in that film, and I think you just touched upon it there, that idea of cinema, how it's rooted in the way in which time and space are manipulated or can be utilised to reflect a certain type of experience. And I think that there were some really interesting sort of juxtapositions between images of the family and the poor people who lived on the island and then these migrants who were coming across. And it wasn't making definite explicit correlations between those two groups, and it was leaving us to make the assertions about what that connection was. And for some people, I think that's kind of difficult to wrap your head around. And maybe, again, that is something that art house cinema and art house documentary does as a matter of course. That's in its kind of like DNA. But it's very different to say to a more mainstream sensibility, in whether you're talking about documentary or film, which is explaining the facts in inverted commas of what's going on and what should be done about it or what is being done about it.
One of the things that I kind of reflected on after seeing the film was how constructed it was, in the sense that there were a lot of events that the director, Rossi, couldn't have staged, when boats arrive and the migrants, you know, and things that are going on in the camp with that many people. But a significant amount of it was clearly staged. But the staging is, it feels based on experiences he's had in the 6 months or the year or whatever. He was just living on the island and working and kind of, you know, being involved in that culture and that landscape. And particularly the stuff around the radio and the domestic scenes in the home, which are, you know, with non-actors who are clearly kind of reliving something that has been witnessed. It's like, well, I'll next time I'll film this, and, you know, kind of cutting it together, which you can see how that jars up against these really kind of immediate images that are captured on the fly, and whether those two things can sit together, and how as an audience member you're supposed to navigate those things. And all that, I mean, when I was watching it, the first 10, 15, 20 minutes, it felt like I was watching a Kiarostami film or an Antonioni film, in terms of the way the, particularly the way the character, in terms of the latter reference, the way the camera was moving our viewpoint around, away from, and towards characters, like in that landscape. It was really subtly done, but
very, yeah, it reminded me of Nick. And sorry, that stuff, just to have, we can edit that bit. Yeah, it really reminded me of Nicolas Philibert or Patricio Guzman. Very similar in terms of sort of the documentary setup of it, of the camera not, or moving between scenes and subjects in a way that isn't connected in an obvious way, and the connections build up over time as it's being filmed.
Absolutely, which then obviously raises those questions about truth, fact, you know, reality and things like that, because it is staged and it is a construction, but it's almost recreating a what could be, you know, described as a truthful moment, because it's happened to the filmmaker, and the filmmaker believes that that moment has a value in the wider context of what they're trying to do. So it's an endlessly fascinating film, but one that really, yeah, does force you to think about not only the content, but yeah, the presentation of these ideas and what this particular presentation is trying to do, without ever saying, here are the answers and here's a really kind of straightforward answer.
Yeah, and one of the things actually that wasn't mentioned, which I thought was really kind of profound, was that the little boy Sam Welly and his friend and their obsession with war and guns and the catapult, and you know, it almost sort of said to me something about the inherent violence of the human condition, and it was raised in the discussion about, you know, what were they at war, and it was almost to me that he was, you know, not saying but alluding to the fact that yes, we are at war, and this is a war between the Western world and what the Western world is and how it's become, you know, dominant, and now we're reaping after hundreds of years of that dominance, which isn't sustainable. And suddenly the lands, the countries that are, you know, in inverted commas, what you might have considered the third world, these things are being brought into contact with each other in a way that they perhaps haven't up until now. And I think maybe, again, that this answers the question of what is transnational cinema and what are some of the things that it can do, or how might you define it? And I think it's possible that it opens up a possibility of looking at these spaces and looking at these identities that are unseen, that are difficult to capture, and also don't have a context. Because, you know, because if you think of kind of like national cinema, that is very much related to how we conceive of a particular national identity or a particular sense of nationhood and how that maybe relates to a country. And it can also be put into the context of how cinema is set up in a national context or a national industry. But a transnational cinema then sort of points to these nether positions and these places that are almost supposedly not meant to be inhabited by people. They're places of transition, they're places of movement, but where identities find themselves stuck, you know, it's like a non-place, you know, whether it's on the in these reception centers and all of these, that there is a non-identity there, even though there are obviously correlations to where people have come from and where people are going. And I think that maybe cinema is able to capture those sort of non-places and non-identities and the sort of problems that people find themselves in, having to be, you know, having to be stuck in the positions of what that actually is like, kind of psychologically, maybe.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting that what you're saying there about the boys and the kind of the obsession with war and how that kind of feels. It kind of goes back to what you're saying in terms of what you as a viewer kind of bring to it and, you know, put onto it. You know, similar to what you're saying about Mother, you know, you're expected to bring yourself to it. A lot of these films do have that. Because I was thinking similarly about that. The film really kind of strongly presents gender roles in that community. And what's interesting is, like, it is this kind of unseen non-space, which is a place of transition, but also a place where these people live. And even in this place, the gender roles, which permeate culture, for want of a better phrase, are still so strongly drawn here. And, you know, almost kind of saying that, you know, nowhere escapes these big ideas of what a boy will grow into, you know, a violence obsessed, you know, worker. and that the women are the mothers, that, you know, and the mother and the kind of the matriarchs in the house. That's how the film presents them, almost. Or that's how I saw them presented. And I think that there are so many, I think everything that you're saying, everything I'm saying, everything the audience is saying is in the film, because it's both a kind of very poetic, subtle portrait of a place, but also it contains within it really clear archetypes and kind of ideas that are just there. They just sort of sit there. And it's only really when a film like this gives the time to investigate and dwell on that stuff that we give those kind of ideas due attention. I think what was interesting was this idea of the news, which kind of came up, you know, and the way that we move, and you mentioned earlier in terms of Brexit and Trump, you know, we are dragged through onto something else so quickly. And it feels like this season and this film give us a much needed chance to sit and dwell in it and think about it. And obviously it's a kind of luxury for people like us to do that, but it also feels like something we should be doing.
I do want to push back, though, on the idea of sort of cinema good, news bad. though, in terms of the way that they present these important issues. Like, say, for example, I remember when, you know, the Syria crisis was at its height and the Mediterranean crossings were the worst, at, you know, during the worst period. And the whole week, Channel 4 News spent like half an hour at 7 o'clock every single night. And I just remember just being in bits watching it all, you know, night after night. And I think that that coverage was absolutely brilliant. It was superb. But like you say, I don't think it's the problem with the medium, the structure of the medium, rather than the content within it, that is the problem there. And, you know, I mean, I think both of us would sort of, the thing that we're criticizing is the sort of really problematic representations, I think, that you see on, you know, newspapers that we all know about. You know, that kind of thing is really problematic. But I think that, you know, the idea that I think it just draws the attention to the fact that the cinematic and the televisual are two different things, and you can't sort of go in, or it's problematic to go into a cinema saying, oh, this hasn't explained everything to me, because a piece of cinema shouldn't be trying to do. Or I don't think that it's slightly different in the fact that the onus is on a film to do something different in terms of allowing the audience to come to the text. Whereas I think in like an half an hour or a 20 minute or a 10 minute news segment, its duty is to relay certain factual contextual issues in a very formulaic way. That's its job. It's got to do that. So I do want to push back against that idea that news is inherently bad and cinema always does something better than that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, and you are right to kind of point out, yeah, that like with cinema, it's not all bad. You know, that there are examples where there's good practice, you know, as a term that we use well, and that has to be remembered. And also, yeah, that there is a difference between the forms. So yeah, well pointed out.
Lovely. So let's move on to our next section, shall we? So this is you and Laura Canning, discussing John Akinfra's The Nine Muses.
Some nice woos there. Thank you very much. Welcome to the Cinematologist podcast. My name is Neil Fox, and I'm joined by my colleague Laura Canning. Hello, Laura.
Hi there.
I'm really good, thanks. Thanks for asking. We are here at the Poly in Falmouth, and we are screening John Akinfra's The Nine Muses. You have curated a wonderful season of films that are playing around Cornwall as part of an ICA and Goethe Institute kind of collaboration with the School of Film and Television called Crossings. And can you tell us what the season is sort of your involvement in it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the brainchild of the ICA, the Institute of Contemporary Arts, Film and Cinema Programme Manager, who is a chap by the name of Nico Marzano. And Nico really felt, as a migrant himself and as somebody with the power to put on seasons like this, that it was really important in the current political climate that he tried to do something to show stories of migration above and beyond the kind of casual stereotyping and the kind of very shallow discourse that we see in the news and online about the real lives of people who are undertaking great journeys. And the other thing he wanted to do was to look at how we have evolved cinematic language to deal with these kinds of stories and how do we tell them. So the result of it is this nationwide programme encompassing feature films, documentaries from contemporary work stretching back to, say, the 1970s. And it's gone around Britain now at this stage, everywhere from Dundee to Cambridge, Bristol. And the reason it's come to Cornwall is Nico was a student of mine previously, and he came to Falmouth University last year and gave a really inspirational lecture, largely about his work on the Frames of Representation Experimental Documentary Festival that he heads up. But we wanted to work together, and he told me about this project, and I felt not only was it worth doing, but I felt that was also something that very much dovetailed with the values of the School of Film and Television at Falmouth. And thankfully, our bosses, Kingsley Marshall and Professor Chris Morris, felt similarly. So not only have we brought it to Cornwall, but we've actually sponsored the programme nationwide. So we're actually helping to bring these films all over the UK. As part of that, I think from a very personal basis as an immigrant myself, I also felt that it was important for universities to challenge the discourses which suggest that internationalism is dead, that intellectual freedom is dead, and that the free movement of people and ideas is something to be feared rather than celebrated. So for me, that's what a lot of these screenings are about. They're about challenging those kinds of casual preconception and about sometimes putting ourselves in other people's shoes more than we normally would.
And I think that the choice of tonight's film is kind of apt in those, you know, in those senses. Particularly. So why did you want to put this film on as part of that programme?
Well, for me, there's no way to put on a season of screenings about migration, particularly in Britain, without referring to the work of John Acumphra. His entire body of work, going back to the 1980s with the Black Audio Film Collective, which came out of Portsmouth Polytechnic as it was then, and was, you know, lots of young, vibrant Black British filmmakers and visual artists and so on. His work has consistently referenced memory, identity, post-colonial responsibility, if you like, diaspora, migration, and he does this in a very poetic manner, and his work in a lot of ways straddles that awkward space between the cinema and the gallery. So it's one of the reasons you tend not to see his work on a big screen in a cinema setting. And I think it should be all the more interesting for that. I think as he describes himself as a post-migrant, the first post-migrant generation, in that his own background is Ghanaian and he was born in Ghana but grew up in Britain as the child of migrants himself. So that's very central to his work and very central to the film we're seeing tonight.
Yeah, I think it's interesting what you're saying there in terms of where the work sits in a space, because obviously that is directly related to the kind of the commonly told stories of those who undertake migration, which is the feeling of no place, of, you know, not having a home, you know, and not being at home in the place that they arrive, which I think is absolutely fascinating in his work. And what's interesting is about the type of films that he makes is that, you know, they're sometimes labelled documentary, but kind of criticised for being subjective, because there is this idea that documentary should be objective, obviously, which we know is kind of impossible and kind of problematic. But it's almost used as a weapon to say that, oh, being subjective is not being authentic. And he seems to relish that space, you know, and really be defiant about creating work which is poetic, essay film, documentary based, and almost to say, well, we are, you know, the work they did with the Handsworth Songs and the Black Audio Film Collective, we are challenging your idea of what the work should be, which I think is incredibly powerful, and why he is one of the most important filmmakers we've had in the last in this country in the last 30 years. So.
Yeah, he talks a lot about his early work having been distrusted because it was coming, it's highly constructed, and it was coming in an era where you had, if you like, the tail end of almost an anthropological approach to documentary. It must be seen to reveal some pre-existing truth. It must be seen to be, say, maybe filmed in a verite style. It must be approached in a sort of a sincere manner, which takes, if you like, the subjectivity of the camera away. And that's really, really not his approach. It's much more visual arts based. He describes himself as somebody working in time-based media. So his work is very much designed to cross borders, both institutionally. He's worked to a certain extent in television, as well as film, as well as the gallery space. And he crosses borders, obviously, in terms of the subject matter of his work. And he crosses borders formally. And I think that's really, really interesting in this context.
A good place to stop the intro and get into the screening. So thanks, Laura. That's great. And let's all watch The Nine Muses. Thank you. thank you very much. Thanks for coming out. Thanks for staying. I'm gonna ask you to start us off, Laura.
To parse the poetry.
Yeah.
I think it's really illustrative of something that I find fascinating about the mode that is poetic documentary, but that I know a lot of people find really infuriating and inaccessible, which is that it requires you to enter into this very particular space of meditative curiosity or curious meditativeness in order to produce its effect, which is so individual and so particular, because the layer upon layer of sound and images is almost designed to direct you away from concrete conclusions, such that it's almost as if every specific individual reaction is just that, in the same way that the sound of a bell being struck by a hammer is the sound of only that bell. And that's one of the things I find rather inspiring about a piece of work like this, but which I know that it can leave a lot of people feeling very lost.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of woven into the story as well. That I mean, I just found it kind of overwhelming in just like the amount of things it was asking me to consider, you know. And it was just beautifully constructed, and almost saying like, you know, don't worry, this is going to be here. You can come back and work through. There's a lot here, because how could any piece of work encapsulate this, the story and these stories? I thought it was beautifully made. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, I just couldn't work out how the archive spoke to the DV, spoke to the HD, like, but he knows, he has his version. And I think, yeah, like you're saying, there is so much to kind of project onto it, and kind of wrestle with in a great way. It's just a stunning piece. And what an experience to see it on a screen like that, where it absolutely envelops.
I love that idea that you have to, with a big screen in a cinematic space, you have to confront the image. You can't just look away at the couch, or you can't just make a cup of tea. You have to really engage with the form, and you have to stick with it whether you like it or not. And maybe that's a metaphor for this entire film, I don't know. One of the preoccupations that John Acumpra has had over the last 10 years is this idea that to speak of migration as a modern phenomenon is inaccurate and sort of unhelpful and anachronistic, because for him, the entire history of humanity is the story of migration. And I think this is why he melds this kind of Homeric approach, that real embedding it in the structures of ancient Greek mythology and so on, and also how he can then integrate things like Shakespeare and T.S. Eliot and Dylan Thomas and James Joyce and all of those elements of British cultural history, which, as each migrant becomes their own Odysseus and makes that journey, become part of their life and their culture too. So I think maybe seeing it as a palimpsest, this idea of a parchment that is never really scraped clean, the traces of the previous layer are always just underneath whatever you've written on it, I think is something that recurs.
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote the phrase in my notebook, unrelenting whiteness, about that landscape that they're in, which just was just so overpowering. And I don't know if that's kind of intentional or provocative, because I think it was a very provocative film in the way it merges what is said with the images, you know, those choice of images to kind of accompany that dialogue at that time or that music at that time. I think it's, you know, and also the provocation of the comedy section being the bleakest, darkest, you know, section.
The moment with the rivers of blood.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, and it's, yeah. I just think that, you know, it's, yeah, it's just...
The whiteness is interesting because, again, it's one of those things that everybody can read it in their own very specific way. And for me, I see it almost as a kind of an emotional analogy. This idea that as a migrant, the landscape you enter into is unfamiliar, maybe alienating, isolating, has its moments of beauty and grandeur or whatever, but is deeply unfamiliar and kind of unheimlich, that sense that it's not home. And maybe that's what's being captured there.
All sorts, I think, being captured. Okay, hopefully, I'm sure people have got things they want to ask or say. So anybody wanted to over there?
So would you say that that film was purely an artistic endeavour? Did he actually want to provoke some kind of conversation or thought from it?
He says he doesn't make explicitly political films so much as he makes films which are about situations that are themselves inherently political. Does that kind of make sense? His,
I guess so, because the only thing I had with it was if he was trying to, like I say, provoke a conversation or something, I feel like that film would only speak to such a small amount of people at such a kind of niche market. That the conversation wouldn't spread very far, you know what I mean? Because it was so kind of cryptic.
But what is that? Obviously. Yeah, but who is that niche market? And do they need to have that conversation?
Yeah, I'm not sure that they do, really. That's what I mean. Like, I don't know if it needs to be a wider market that it needs to reach. Like, if more people need to think about that subject rather than just the artistic community, which I think that film would only speak to. I don't think it would speak to the common man, if you will, because they just won't have time for it, I don't think.
I think there's a danger sometimes in generalising about what a film is for or who its audience is supposed to be. And the idea that because something is, if you like, billed as documentary, that it must function in specific ways. John Okomfor himself, I mentioned previously that he sort of straddles this divide between the gallery space and the cinema space. And so I think in that sense, you're absolutely right. Is this a case of preaching to the converted? But he also talks about going into gallery situations and the joy of coming across something you never expected to see, showing in a gallery, or that 15 minutes that you can pop into a gallery before you have to pick the kids up from school or whatever it is, and the idea that you may encounter something wholly unexpected to you within that space and place. So I think that's more where he's coming from than anything that you might describe as more crusading, so to speak. For him, a lot of it's about documenting history, but in very poetic ways. And again, I think there are very oblique references there and much more direct ones as well, in the way that what we might call classically white British culture is foregrounded a lot in the soundtrack and the on-screen wording. Which makes direct reference in a lot of ways to, for example, the Windrush generation, that generation from the West Indies that post-World War II was shipped over to the UK to kind of pick up the pieces. They had been raised their whole lives to see Britain as their cultural motherland, that Shakespeare was their inheritance, that all of British culture was theirs, that they were British. And then to come to very austere, very depressed post-war Britain, where they were not necessarily welcomed, where they were in many cases exploited and ostracized, was a culturally very alienating experience for them. And that's also, I think, a process he's documenting.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of dangerous to, you know, assume an understanding on behalf of a group of people that are not yourself, or you assume are kind of not addressed by a piece of work. And I think what's interesting about that is that, you know, it's the Shakespeare, the Joyce, Joyce probably, but definitely Shakespeare, and kind of the use of Greek classics, kind of says to, you know, kind of references the fact that those are populist works in their time. You know, when the oral tradition, you know, when Homer was telling the story of the Odyssey, he was telling it to the common man in that way, the everyman. Now that's considered a very deep, dense text, which is the preserve of classicists. Shakespeare was, you know, penny theatre, you know, for the masses, and is now considered difficult, and many people say they find it very difficult to access because of shifts in time, shifts in the changes in culture, shifts in the way we regard certain works. So I think it's very brave to place all that stuff alongside each other. And I think that, yeah, I think, you know, Laura's talking about what his intention is. His assumption is that, you know, people are intelligent regardless of their background, and people can read into it and take out from it what they need and what they want. And assuming that people can't, keeps it the preserve. You know, it keeps it with the preserve of galleries, and it keeps it. And obviously, he has a very personal journey that he's on as an artist. And I think it's not necessarily up to him, but it's up to us to broaden out that discussion and to, you know, to screen it on day three of a university film education, which I think, you know, and kind of challenge that and ask, you know, who should be talking about it. I think everybody, you know, it does
bring us back to these kind of large questions about culture and who culture belongs to as well, because I noticed obviously that the Irish migrant experience is directly referenced in there, and as somebody who is a migrant myself, but also the daughter and granddaughter of migrants, my grandfather, who worked on the building sites back in the 1950s, you know, again, with people who come from the West Indies and so on, in Dagenham, used to talk about how there'd be plenty of people he would work with who might be illiterate, but they could sing arias from a dozen different operas fluently in Italian and had a tremendous grasp of high culture in all sorts of various ways. So that layering, I think, of cultural experience and cultural interpretation is something that you see as part of the migrant experience, and it becomes then part of the if you like, calling them the host nation. I don't like that as a phrase. You know, it implies parasite hosts. It's a terrible phrase. But it becomes then part of the experience of the broader culture as well as the migrant culture. Maybe.
Yeah. Great, thank you. Next, anyone else? Oh, there's one down the front here. Yeah.
Well, I've not really got a question from a statement of what I thought of it. I felt like I was looking at two separate gallery pieces, like a photo series on isolation and it being set in what I'm assuming is a Nordic country and the coldness and the sort of isolation there. And then it felt like I was at the Imperial War Museum as well. Like, I can remember going last year and they stopped everything, they stopped all the exhibits, and they're projecting imagery and using found footage and sound all overlay to give this view of, I think it was life in Britain in World War II. And it reminded me of a film that I saw, a film called Iron Belfast, where it was this beautiful, beautiful imagery, but then overlaid with found footage. And it's quite jarring to me, the whole style of it, but it weirdly works. I wouldn't choose to watch something like that, but it's definitely more of an art piece to me than a film.
Well, I think it's both. I think that's the idea of showing it, isn't it? You know, is like what is a film? And I think there will be as many emotional responses to it as formal responses, and people's opinions on what it is as a piece of work, it, again, is informed by their own understanding or their own beliefs or their own kind of cultural ideas around, you know, what a documentary is. You know, is that a documentary? Well, there's a lot of kind of staged, you know, almost kind of weird stills, moving image kind of, you know, is it a poem, film, or not really? You know, like, and I think that's okay. And it's okay to be more than one thing. And I think that too often there's, you know, which is why I was talking about this when we talked about Fire at Sea, which was the other film we showed for the podcast, was, you know, that migration is a conversation that people want to narrow down to a very, very simple, you know, idea of us and them and, you know, the invaders or whatever, you know, whatever the narrative is, they want it to be simple. And it's not simple. And I think what this film does through its cultural history is to suggest that there is a colonial history and that there is a long, long history that has built up to this moment that is kind of mostly represented in the archive, but it's complex and it can't be contained in a simple definition. And I think the work is a formal representation of that idea, which is why I found it very powerful, because it is form and subject without being about any specific people or you know.
I suspect it's a film you can come back to and revisit at various periods of your life, having had different experiences and engagements with other people and other cultures, and see specific elements of it in very different ways. So again, that's something I really enjoy, that sort of nebulous, slightly nebulous quality that requires you to give something of yourself to it,
yeah.
which a lot of films, you know, don't do. We have the, you know, a problem really with films that are, if you like, narratively soporific. They're just endlessly reassuring. Even if there is temporary jeopardy, we know it'll be resolved in Act Three, and something like this, which is doing something much more epic and difficult, therefore requires so much more of us as viewers.
I'm on a like, conflicted about what I think about the film. I'm trying to think about how I'm viewing it. I'm trying to say it's more of like an avant-garde kind of, or a documentary kind of film. Actually, you know, what do you think? Because it's kind of a narrative going through, like a natural progression of race, like racial attitudes, videos, and
yeah, it is really attempting to straddle those boundaries between, as I keep saying, the gallery and the cinema, between narrative form and a looser, more impressionistic construction of imagery. And the extent to which it sort of does that successfully or otherwise is probably down to the individual interpretation of it, really. Does he fall squarely into an avant-garde tradition? I'm actually inclined to think that he doesn't necessarily fall into the classically modernist avant-garde structure so much as into that, a visual version of that kind of oral history,
yeah,
that you were talking about. I think there's a clue almost in the name of his 1980s collective endeavour, the Black Audio Film Collective, yeah. Because they were focused very much on kind of cross-media, what we would now call multimedia projects, rather than maybe a kind of a modernist avant-garde approach.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good shout. I think the word narrative is interesting because although the film is devoid of what might be, you know, an expected narrative when watching either a documentary or a narrative film, narrative is a key word in the sense that the film knows that you will bring a narrative to it because of the way you will watch films and what you expect from a film. So there's that element of narrative, but it's also about narratives. It's about the narrative of migration and the people who undertake it, and also the narrative of what migration is and how it's kind of represented, you know, outside of those people whose experience it directly is. So I think that that's a good word, and I think that those conflicted feelings are great, you know, because I think that we hope that you're challenged and conflicted by what you see and don't quite understand it. I don't quite understand it. I mean, there's things in there I just have no, you know, I don't know how the DV footage of I think it's Liverpool, you know, those kind of, I can't work out how that relates, you know, and even if it does or even if it's supposed to, I don't know, and it might not be, and I love that because I'll think about that for days and I'll live with the film, and that's great, you know. So don't shy away from being conflicted. And yeah, most all those things that you're seeing in it are there, you know. I wouldn't say they were.
Yeah. It is. There's so much you can read into it. One of the things that's important to remember, I think, about how John Acumfer approaches his work as well, is to say that he's very keen on what he sees as challenging received history. So sometimes, for a filmmaker who's interested in destabilizing what you might call national narratives, oh, this is what Britain looks like, this is how Britain's history evolved, this is who Britain is, he's not so much interested in providing answers to that are challenging that structure so much as he is destabilizing your understanding of how those histories and narratives might work and challenging you to try and revisit history or to challenge your understanding of how history works and how national narratives are constructed.
Yeah, and to bring that back to the first question about in terms of the who you thought that the audience might be, you know, they will, like, if they've, you know, that audience that you're thinking of is likely an audience in a position of power in terms of culture and creative, you know, and I think that is definitely a challenge in the film, is to rethink about how people who have that power to create stuff and make work to represent history and histories use that power, and have used that power over centuries, and you know, in terms of how they represent that, and that, you know, makes me uncomfortable in a good way when I watch stuff like that. You know, what's the complicity here? What's my responsibility? Now I've been reminded of these things and these ideas so beautifully as well. Not hammered home, not didactic, not, you know, just a beautifully emotive kind of experience.
And the archive footage, again, those little glimpses into individual lives, I think add such kind of, just, I hesitate to use the word emotion to it, because in some ways this is a film which sort of steps back from that. It's not being sentimental about, you know, migrant experience or anything like that. Just the half glance into someone's life. Often the shot being cut right as you get to the point of emotional engagement, say with the camera, that another filmmaker might push. It's like he looks away. And so you get a half glance into someone's life, just a half shadow of what their existence is like.
Yeah, and then where you're asked to look next, yeah. Which I think is, yeah, fascinating. Anyone else? Oh yeah, we've got a few more here, yeah. Cool.
What's your interpretation of the people in the jackets, the blue and yellow jackets?
Anyone? Yeah, should we have one from the back, from Matt at the back? Matt's probably got an idea of it. Yes, please, yeah, sorry.
I didn't particularly have an interpretation of the jackets, but those scenes did hark back to a memory for me of my experience. It's going to sound horrific when I first said it, but it harked back to a memory for me of watching the film The Revenant, which I thought, you know, it's just a lone figure in a massively kind of like a snowy environment. And then I was immediately sort of horrified of myself when The Revenant scene. And I thought, this is just such a completely different film. And then I thought, well, actually, it's really not. It's a film where they're both films that try to tackle the migrant situation, but from incredibly sort of stuck and polarized, one very sort of Hollywood style kind of glorification of this, a triumphant sort of tackling of arriving in a very alien environment and succeeding, and kind of overcoming, and being the kind of victor in that environment. And then this other one of an enormous mass of people who arrive in a similarly sort of inhospitable environment and are not victorious and suffer in enormous numbers. So I was, you know, that was my kind of reading of my very personalized reading of that kind of situation. And it also sort of spoke to me of this, of how kind of like a tribal culture becomes individualized when it goes on a migratory path, and how lots of kind of a mass of people suddenly become very kind of singularized in a landscape. I'm sure that's the experience of quite a few sort of people sitting in this room today. It's quite interesting that this has been screened on day three of what the many people in this room must be. Very kind of like isolating experience of coming down here, yeah. And sort of seeing everything new and fresh, you know, kind of looking out, and so I'm sure you all love to see sort of the beauty of that, but also something of the hostility, the kind of the weather and the sort of the frightening ships out and where are they going, what are they doing? So there was something of that in that kind of
Yeah, and then they're students as well, and there's a kind of connotation around being a student in a place, you know, and how the, for want of a better phrase, locals will take to that arrival of a group of people, you know. And it did kind of hark to me, that idea of the pioneer and that kind of that journey of the, you know, into the wilderness, into that, you know. And I kept thinking of the book Guns, Germs and Steel all the way through, you know, and this idea of, which I think, you know, which probably me reading onto it in terms of the fact that, you know, the stories that represented it and John Okumfor's kind of background as well, is like where that started on this planet, you know, and who started that journey away from their home, first of all, you know, and the idea that it was, you know, it was black people in Africa who started the move, and then civilization has kind of come from that, you know, and almost kind of bringing it round to back to that, you know, and that the I thought the use of the Odyssey was beautiful because it's kind of suggesting, well, actually, this is, we assume that the journey is over, you know, when people are in England or in the West, you know, but it, is it, and is it not, and is it saying, this is one of the trials, this period, this 60 years, you know, if you read the Odyssey, they're away for a long time, you know, they battle for a long time away from home, home, whatever that means, you know, away from where they're from, and it's a trial, and is this a trial, and is this just a part of this history that is going to be a chapter, that is going to be, you know, and I just found it so, yeah, so interesting, you know.
That Homeric structure, I think, is really interesting, also in the way in which, was we mentioned before, there are so many sort of elitist high culture references, and the Odyssey has become a high culture reference against its own much more folkloric roots. But if you like, the contrast between the way in which one set of migrants is venerated historically and lionized and made part of this elite narrative, you know, and so many later migrants receive exactly the opposite treatment. They are framed as parasites, insects, cockroaches. I mean, the rhetoric against people who have the temerity to leave is you know, vile and violent and rage-inducing, you know. And John O'Comfer says, you know, it seems that British people are willing to accept, you know, tomatoes from Italy and grapes from Jamaica and whatever it is from everywhere. Everything except people.
Yeah.
That's all they want, their materiality. They do not want people. So I think that's very strongly drawn out there. And those anorakt, faceless figures that you see, you can read them, again, as part of this tremendously inhospitable, strange landscape, as being the epic solo adventurer. You can also read the other side of that coin, which is the isolation, the deep strangeness you feel, no matter how privileged you are as a migrant, once you realize you are no longer home, and you are not of this place either. You are, in fact, no place. Yeah. So I think that sort of facelessness is really...
And then, but those ideas are bound up in the same person and the same people, you know, and the stories of migration are both those stories, you know. Many people leave their families and hope in order to survive, and so that their family can survive. So that heroism and that desire to go and succeed and be a victor is also... You know, is also in that, yeah. So, well, let's keep going because a few more people wanted to say stuff. So there's a couple down here. Thanks everyone so far. This is great. It's really good.
Okay, so like in there, I know there's kind of three very distinct styles of like camel work. There's the old found footage from, you know, the sort of post-war period with the assimilation of new migrants, and then there's the sort of mid to late 90s digital camera, sort of slightly pixelated, just about noticeable. And then, of course, there's like the Ultra HD. I kind of interpreted that as being like three different periods of like civil rights acceptance. So, like in the post-war period, there's sort of quite a lot of prejudice, and that. And then, sort of in the mid to late 90s, that there was a lot of like flaring up prejudice once again, sort of coming over from America. And then in like the modern day, with our modern progression, we've now sort of reached a new stage of like uniformity, which is what I saw in like the big like uniform white landscape. What would you say your interpretation is of those two different types of camera work?
I think that's a pretty good interpretation in terms of, yeah, the way it kind of represents time. And the movement of time through it. Yeah,
I see where you're coming from. Again, I think it takes us back to the idea of the palimpsest, layers of, in time, and the fact that he sees himself as somebody who works in time-based media. So, yeah, at the same time, I think there's a danger of seeing kind of narrative of progression because we are so desperate inherently to project narrative structure onto images. Sometimes there's a tendency to go, okay, well, then the most contemporary to us narrative is the successful one, so to speak. It's demonstrating integration and assimilation and all the rest of it. When in actual fact, we are on, you know, we are on the brink, if not in, one of the greatest periods of intolerance, I think, that we've seen in the last 100 years. Mm. So, you know, I think it would be a mistake to regard it as a kind of a reassuring progression, but I think you're absolutely correct on the technical side of it. It is that layering across time.
And is technical progress cultural progress? Not always. Hello, Facebook.
Somewhat following that, I found that with these kind of ambiguous pieces, I would question what is purposely lacking from it. So reflecting upon that, I thought, well, why don't they go so far as to say have newspaper clippings? There's not really time. It's like time is a lost concept throughout all of this kind of documentary or whatever piece we decided to call it. And I was just contemplating to see how, you know, we're giving these snippets of the past, but the present that is in this high resolution of this beautiful landscape shot is limited and lacking in the world that we live in. It's isolated, rural, there's mountain sides, it's nothing you would call home or very much welcoming. So when you do get these kind of iconic places in London and city, you kind of then are forced as the viewer to think, how is it now? Has much has changed from what I'm viewing now to see when I'm walking the street, do I see people smiling and laughing? Or I'm still looking at the world in a sense that we're still viewing it now, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's a really nice reading of it. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I really like your approach to it. Yeah.
Apologies for the conciseness of that.
No, that's fine. You did great. That's fine.
You're with us. What concision is there?
No. Some concision would be nice up here, I think people are asking for. Oh, there's one down here, Dave. Is there anyone else? Yeah, there's one down. Probably keep this. If anyone, no one has got any more, make this the last one. Sorry.
I thought like the loss of time was because all of the problems within immigration and all of that is so relevant today. For instance, I thought the two blue and yellow jackets, I thought they were supposed to be representative of the EU, because of the times. And I thought because they were like surrounded by mountains and all of that white and isolation, I thought it was like they were kind of being a metaphor for the Greek gods being surrounded by Mount Olympus. And just they were supposed to be completely like unreachable for the people on this journey. That was what I thought. But I think that might just be because of now.
I'm impressed by how many varying elements everyone has pulled out, actually.
So. Yeah, I mean, it was made a few years ago, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's kind of pre... Yeah. But what I think what you kind of do hit on there is the idea that it's... He doesn't necessarily think that it's a solvable problem or something that has a kind of time limit on it, and it will keep recurring. And I think that the EU jackets is a beautiful kind of happenstance, which gives the theme, which is great, isn't it? It gives the film meaning a few years after it's made because of the specific context, but also the timelessness of what the film is about and the recurring nature of it, which kind of, yeah, it is, I might say more powerful, but it has a different power watching it a year after Brexit, you know, definitely, you know, particularly the archive footage, you know,
To be continued.
Oh, one more, yeah, just up there before we end, and then we'll wrap it up.
So, I don't really have a question. I just wanted to, like, give you guys the perspective of an international student.
Great.
Because, like, I've been living here, like, for 5 or 6 days now, and some moments in this film were so powerful, you know, because, yeah, the people are really nice here, but there's always that feeling that we're different, you know. It's like, English is not our first language. And yeah, thank you for showing this. I'm getting emotional right here because it was really powerful. So I just wanted to thank you guys, and I hope to see you with more films like this. Thank you.
Well, you've come to the right place. And I don't think we should move on from that. I think that's the perfect place to end. Thank you all for coming out. This will be up on iTunes and on our website, cinematologist.com, middle of next week, I think. So thank you for coming out. Hope you tune in. Yeah, that was great. Thank you very much.
Okay, so another great discussion there with a lot of interesting points and clearly a sort of diverse set of voices, you know, a big audience, as you said, which was great. I haven't seen the film, so I can't comment at this point, but I know that you wanted to sum up in terms of the two films that we've put on today and this sort of season as a whole. So what did you want to say, Neil?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the point that was made at the start of the Nine Muses sort of Q&A section about the who will see the film and who's the audience for the film and whether it is just kind of preaching to the converted, I think is something that really needs to be thought about, because I was thinking about it, I think, well, and as I mentioned in there, I think it is dangerous to assume that you have to be of a certain education or level or type of person in order to be able to access what these films are doing. And I think that, again, the problem comes down in terms of where they're seen and how they're seen and how they're presented and whether people are given the opportunity to see that. I'm not saying that they would be Marvel-esque blockbusters and that everyone's, you know, but I think that more, I do believe, and I think that maybe that might be naive optimism, but I do believe there's more people who would enjoy and have a kind of positive and engaged experience with this work if they had more access to it. And, you know, for example, in New Lynn, that was a film that was on the list that Laura sort of put together, Dr. Laura Canning, my colleague, who sort of programmed the season down here in Cornwall. And that's what they picked because they'd screened it before and they hadn't quite got the response they wanted, and they wanted another chance as a cinema to get people out. And we had a really nice crowd of, you know, again, if it's a very lame phrase, but it's regular cinema goers. I'm sure people will know what I mean, you know, in this context. Just people who go to the cinema and people who aren't involved in the film industry or studying it or anything like that. They're just people coming out to watch a film, and they came out and they engaged with it on its own terms. And like hopefully people heard, you know, there was a real validity to the, which sounds patronising, but I don't know how else to put it, to how they responded to it, because there isn't really an invalid response to it in that sense. And I think it is important that when we talk about this stuff, we do talk about the context in which it's shown, and remember that seasons like this, where investment is made to get great films, both in terms of cinema and also kind of important films in terms of a cultural discussion, back into cinemas or into cinemas in the first place, so that as wide an audience as possible does have access to them. And I think that exhibition and distribution is a problem, which means that a lot of these films are released, play in an art house circuit with a very, very particular type of audience, and then kind of disappear online. And that's an economic thing rather than anything else. And I think that there has to be pushback. And that's why it was so great to screen these films, and Blackboards as well in Truro had a similar response, with really good audiences who came out and just engaged with the film because it was something different. And I think that was the key to the season and the key to, you know, to keep fighting the fight that we're fighting on the podcast in terms of the types of films we talk about, because there is a tiredness amongst audiences for the same old stuff, and a willingness to see stuff on the big screen. And both The Nine Muses and Fire at Sea are exquisite big screen experiences. They are, I would argue, infinitely more challenging and uncomfortable and kind of draining experiences because of the hugeness of the screen, that overwhelming sense of what you're seeing and being directed so subtly to experience things in a certain way in terms of sound design and composition is different in the cinema and does have, I would believe, a weightier emotional impact in the moment, because you just can't escape, what's going on in the same way that you can escape when you're, you know, watching on an iPad or watching on or even on your TV. So I think it is important that we fight the idea that these films preach to the converted, and make sure that we do what we can, the way we talk about them, the way we present them, and the types of cinema that we talk about, that we assume that everybody can grasp what we're talking about and can grasp what these films are trying to do, and don't kind of slip into assuming that a kind of small elite is the only people who can decipher the codes. And I know I don't want to kind of criticise that student who was a fresher, who was really vocal and really interesting point, and I'm not criticising that at all, because you can completely understand when you watch a piece of work like that wrestling with those things, and I'm so glad that that student wrestled with them, and obviously it's my job to help, you know, widen understanding of cinema and audiences and things like that. So this is not a criticism, but it did make me think, actually, no, there's, again, like the subjects of the films, there's a lot going on here which needs unpacking and talking about and deciphering, and it's not as simple as these are kind of elite art house films for a small audience, I don't think.
Yeah, you cover an awful lot there, and you know, these are the things that we are really kind of thinking about all the time. I do think it is unreal. I do think we are in a kind of difficult time, you know, for lots of different reasons. But one of the main things is that we are in a difficult place when it comes to what the expectations of audiences are. And I think that the structure of distribution, which you mentioned, means that the diet of films that is seen on a big screen in the auditorium is narrower than it's ever been, even though the possibilities of what you can see is wider than it's ever been. So it's a kind of paradoxical situation. So therefore, I mean, I was trying to wrestle with some of this in the blog that I wrote recently called Just Love Movies. But that idea that I think that there are audiences out there who would come to this stuff, but they almost need to be awoken from the mediocre expectations of what they normally see at the cinema. I'm not saying that, like, you know, mainstream films are all mediocre, but what I'm saying is the palette of what is encountered is narrower. So therefore, I think it isn't, we have to be realistic. I think it's incumbent on us to realize that if you put Fire at Sea on or The Nine Muses on a Tuesday night with no context around it, in most places, it's not going to get an audience. It may get a specific audience in an art house cinema because people go to that art house cinema to see art house films, right? But again, that will be a very small audience. So I think it is, you know, incumbent on those people who do see a value and understand the broader possibilities of what cinema could be in all its forms to provide that context for those films when they are screened, and be mindful that that's an opportunity rather than something that we should just kind of bury our heads in our hands and say, oh Christ, nobody goes out and sees these films anymore. We are in the situation that we are in terms of distribution, in terms of exhibition, and it's incumbent on us as film educators and as those that advocate certain types of film viewing and certain types of film text that we want people to see, to use the podcast and to use our voices to say, look, come and see this film. We're going to introduce it, or it's being introduced in you know, whatever setting it is. Go and see it. It's worth seeing. And I think people will get something out of that. But we've got to recognize that it isn't going to happen by itself anymore. And if something like Fire at Sea and The Nine Muses gets buried online, it will, again, only get seen by a certain type of audience. And I think it is incumbent on us to recognize that you put that in front of an audience of a diverse range of voices and a diverse range of understandings of film, again, without being condescending, it will get through and people will recognize it and they will take the time out to wrestle with it, even if they're not used to seeing those kind of movies. And I do understand that something like The Nine Muses, even though I haven't seen it, I've read about it being kind of difficult to access, you know, but giving the people the opportunity to try and access it is what we should be doing, rather than saying, oh well, nobody's going to come out and see that. You know, we've got to be on the forefront of that battle and not get down about it that people aren't automatically going out to see that, because they just won't. Yeah. It's got to be placed in a context, and we're the kind of people who hopefully are at the forefront of that fight.
I think that's beautifully put, and it does. It's very much in line with what Laura was sort of saying in terms of the university's role in these types of stories. You know, with, as you sort of alluded to very early in the podcast, you know, these overhanging things about Brexit and Trump and where the migrant conversation sits in the culture. It's important that we make a stand. When Laura sort of, and Kingsley sort of said, you know, we're putting on this season, and Kingsley sort of said that, you know, the school was funding a national program and kind of doing this and kind of getting involved. It was like, wow, that's brilliant. That's what we want to see. And that the ICA are investing in a program like this, a difficult work, and rolling it out it's important. And it's great to be asked to do a podcast about it, because like you say, this is what we're here for. So I think you put that really well, really passionately. Sure, there'll be more, you know, more soldiers at the fighting the cause.
Lovely. Well, I think that'll just about do it. Lots of content today. Well done on the edit, because obviously when we're taping, you haven't done it yet, but when it'll go out, you will have done it. So good luck and congratulations at the same time.
That's very much. I appreciate your faith in me.
I hope you enjoy the process. It's, you know, I mean, I've written about it and we talked about it a lot, the process of sort of learning a new skill. You know, it sort of moves from technical to creative very quickly, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
Well done on that. Podcast this year has brought me a load of new skills. You know, sort of I know it's only Squarespace, but kind of redesigning the website, and I've moved from having a crew of people to recording the events on my own. So the two events today I just recorded with this kind of gear that we've invested in here, and it's just me in a box, you know, and, you know, getting used to kind of recording audio and testing stuff, and then obviously, you know, kind of designing the merch as well. You know, all these are new skills, and it feels great that the podcast has afforded me the opportunity to learn stuff, and it is exciting to get that under my belt and just have these new experiences. So yeah, it is good fun, and I'm sure it'll be another learning experience when I sit down on Sunday and put this all together.
Great. So the next thing that comes up will probably be a shorter bonus episode again, and then we'll be back to a bigger episode in a few weeks' time. So we hope you've enjoyed the content so far this season, and we look forward to your company once again on the Cinematologist podcast. Thanks for listening. Staring with blood in their mouth.